Dr. Alfred Russel Wallace, the eminent naturalist, in the course of a letter to the Times, January 4, 1873, describing his visit to a public medium, said, "I consider it no exaggeration to say that the main facts are now as well established and as easily verifiable as any of the more exceptional phenomena of nature which are not yet reduced to law. They have a most important bearing on the interpretation of history, which is full of narratives of similar facts, and on the nature of life and intellect, on which physical science throws a very feeble and uncertain light, and it is my firm and deliberate belief that every branch of philosophy must suffer till they are honestly and seriously investigated, and dealt with as constituting an essential portion of the phenomena of human nature. One becomes bemused by ectoplasm and laboratory experiments which lead the thoughts away from the essential." Wallace was one of the few whose great, sweeping, unprejudiced mind saw and accepted the truth in its wonderful completeness, from the humble physical proofs of outside power to the highest mental teaching which that power could convey, teaching that far surpasses in beauty and incredibility any which the modern mind has known. The public acceptance and sustained support of this great scientific man, one of the first brains of his age, were the more important since he had the wit to understand the complete religious revolution which lay at the back of these phenomena. It has been a curious fact that, with some exceptions in these days, as of old, the wisdom has been given to the humble and withheld from the learned. Heart and intuition have won to the goal where brain has missed it. One would think that the proposition was a simple one. It may be expressed in a series of questions after the Socratic form. Have we established connection with the intelligence of those who have died? The spiritualist says, yes. Have they given us information of the new life in which they find themselves, and of how it has been affected by their earth life? Again, yes. Have they found it correspond to the account given by any religion upon earth? No. Then if this be so, is it not clear that the new information is of vital religious import? The humble spiritualist sees this and adapts his worship to the facts. Sir William, then Professor, Barrett brought the subject of spiritualism before the British Association for the Advancement of Science in 1876. His paper was entitled On Some Phenomena Associated with Abnormal Conditions of Mind. He had difficulty in obtaining a hearing. The biological committee refused to accept the paper and passed it on to the anthropological subsection, who only accepted it on the casting vote of the chairman, Dr. Alfred Russel Wallace. Colonel Lane Fox helped to overcome the opposition by asking why, as they had discussed ancient witchcraft the previous year, they should not examine modern witchcraft that year. The first part of Professor Barrett's paper dealt with mesmerism, but in the second part he related his experiences of spiritualistic phenomena, and urged that further scientific examination should be given to the subject. He gave the convincing details of a remarkable experience he had had of raps occurring with a child. The Spiritualist, September 22, 1876, Volume 9, pages 87-88. In the ensuing discussion, Sir William Crookes spoke of the levitations he had witnessed with D.D. Home, and said of levitation, "The evidence in favor of it is stronger than the evidence in favor of almost any natural phenomenon the British Association could investigate." He also made the following remarks concerning his own method of psychic research: "I was asked to investigate when Dr. Slade first came over, and I mentioned my conditions. I have never investigated except under these conditions. It must be at my own house, and my own selection of friends and spectators, under my own conditions, and I may do whatever I like as regards apparatus. I have always tried, where it has been possible, to make the physical apparatus test the things themselves, and have not trusted more than is possible to my own senses. But when it is necessary to trust to my senses, I must entirely dissent from Mr. Barrett, when he says a trained physical inquirer is no match for a professional conjurer. I maintain a physical inquirer is more than a match." An important contribution to the discussion was made by Lord Rayleigh, the distinguished mathematician, who said, I think we are much indebted to Professor Barrett for his courage, for it requires some courage to come forward in this matter, and to give us the benefit of his careful experiments. My own interest in the subject dates back 2 years. I was first attracted to it by reading Mr. Crookes's investigations. Although my opportunities have not been so good as those enjoyed by Professor Barrett, I have seen enough to convince me that those are wrong who wish to prevent investigation by casting ridicule on those who may feel inclined to engage in it. The next speaker, Mr. Groom Napier, was greeted with laughter when he described verified psychometric descriptions of people from their handwriting enclosed in sealed envelopes, and when he went on to describe spirit lights that he had seen, the uproar forced him to resume his seat. Professor Barrett, in replying to his critics, said, "It certainly shows the immense advance that this subject has made within the last few years, that a paper on the once laughed at phenomena of so-called spiritualism should have been admitted into the British Association, and should have been permitted to receive the full discussion it has had today." The London Spectator, in an article entitled "The British Association on Professor Barrett's Paper," opened with the following broad-minded view: "Now that we have before us a full report of Professor Barrett's paper, and of the discussion upon it, we may be permitted to express our hope that the British Association will really take some action on the subject of the paper, in spite of the protests of the party which we may call the party of superstitious incredulity." We say superstitious incredulity because it is really a pure superstition, and nothing else, to assume that we are so fully acquainted with the laws of nature, that even carefully examined facts, attested by an experienced observer, ought to be cast aside as utterly unworthy of credit, only because they do not at first sight seem to be in keeping with what is most clearly known already. Sir William Barrett's views steadily progressed until he accepted the spiritualistic position in unequivocal terms before his lamented death in 1925. He lived to see the whole world ameliorate its antagonism to such subjects, though a little difference perhaps could be observed in the British Association, which remained as obscurantist as ever. Such a tendency, however, may not have been an unmixed evil, for, as Sir Oliver Lodge has remarked, if the great pressing material problems had been complicated by psychic issues, it is possible that they would not have been solved. It may be worth remarking that Sir William Barrett, in conversation with the author, recalled that of the four men who supported him upon that historical and difficult occasion, every one lived to receive the Order of Merit, the greatest honor which their country could bestow. The four were Lord Rayleigh, Crookes, Wallace and Huggins. It was not to be expected that the rapid growth of spiritualism would be without its less desirable features. These were of at least two kinds. First, the cry of fraudulent mediumship was frequently heard. In the light of our later, fuller knowledge, we know that much that bears the appearance of fraud is not necessarily fraud at all. At the same time, the unbounded credulity of a section of spiritualists undoubtedly provided an easy field for charlatans. In the course of a paper read before the Cambridge University Society for Psychological Investigation in 1879, the president of the society, Mr. J. A. Campbell, said, "Since the advent of Mr. Home, the number of media has increased yearly, and so has the folly and the imposture. Every spook has become, in the eyes of fools, a divine angel, and not even every spook, but every rogue, dressed up in a sheet, who has chosen or shall choose to call himself a materialized spirit. A so-called religion has been founded in which the honor of the most sacred names has been transferred to the ghosts of pickpockets. Of the characters of which divinities, and of the doctrines taught by them, I shall not insult you by speaking, so it ever is when folly and ignorance get into their hands the weapon of an eternal fact, abuse, distortion, crime itself. Such were ever the results of children playing with edged tools, but who but an ignoramus would cry, naughty knife." Gradually the movement is clearing itself of such excretions, gradually is it becoming more sober and pure, and strong, and as sensible men and educated men study and pray and work, striving to make good use of their knowledge, will it become more so. The Spiritualist, April 11, 1879, p. 170. The second feature was the apparent increase of what may be termed anti-Christian, though not anti-religious, spiritualism. This led to William Howitt and other stalwart supporters ceasing their connection with the movement. Powerful articles against this tendency were contributed to the Spiritual magazine by Howitt and others. A suggestion of the need for caution and balance is afforded in the remarks of Mr. William Stainton Moses, who said in a paper read before the British National Association of Spiritualists on January 26, 1880, "We are emphatically in need of discipline and education. We have hardly yet settled down after our rapid growth. The child, born just 30 years ago, has increased in stature, if not in wisdom, at a very rapid rate. It has grown so fast that its education has been a little neglected. In the expressive phraseology of its native country, it has been dragged up rather promiscuously, and its phenomenal growth has absorbed all other considerations. The time has now come when those who have regarded it as an ugly monster which was born by one of nature's freaks only to die an early death, begin to recognize their mistake. The ugly brat means to live, and beneath its ugliness the least sympathetic gaze detects a coherent purpose in its existence. It is the presentation of a principle inherent in man's nature, a principle which his wisdom has improved away until it is well nigh eliminated altogether, but which crops out again and again in spite of him, the principle of spirit as opposed to matter, of soul acting and existing independently of the body which enshrines it. Long years of denial of aught but the properties of matter have landed the chief lights of modern science in pure materialism. To them, therefore, this spiritualism is a portent and a problem. It is a return to superstition, a survival of savagery, a blot on 19th century intelligence. Laughed at, it laughs back; scorned, it gives back scorn for scorn." The Psychological Review, Volume 2, p. 546. In 1881, Light, a high-class weekly spiritualist newspaper, was begun, and 1882 saw the formation of the Society for Psychical Research. Speaking generally, it may be said that the attitude of organized science during these 30 years was as unreasonable and unscientific as that of Galileo's cardinals, and that if there had been a scientific inquisition, it would have brought its terrors to bear upon the new knowledge. No serious attempt of any sort, up to the formation of the SPR, was made to understand or explain a matter which was engaging the attention of millions of minds. Faraday in 1853 put forward the theory that table moving was caused by muscular pressure, which may be true enough in some cases, but bears no relation to the levitation of tables, and in any case applies only to the one limited class of psychic phenomena. The usual scientific objection was that nothing occurred at all, which neglected the testimony of thousands of credible witnesses. Others argued that what did happen was capable of being exposed by a conjurer, and any clumsy imitation such as Maskline's parody of the Davenports was eagerly hailed as an exposure, with no reference to the fact that the whole mental side of the question with its overwhelming evidence was untouched thereby. The religious people, furious at being shaken out of their time-honored ruts, were ready, like savages, to ascribe any new thing to the devil. Roman Catholics and the evangelical sects, alike, found themselves for once united in their opposition. That low spirits may be reached, and low, lying messages received, is beyond all doubt, since every class of spirit exists around us, and like attracts like, but the lofty, sustaining and philosophic teaching which comes to every serious and humble-minded inquirer shows that it is angelism and not diabolism which is within our reach. Dr. Carpenter put forward some complex theory, but seems to have been in a minority of one in its acceptance or even in its comprehension. The doctors had an explanation founded upon the cracking of joints, which is ludicrous to anyone who has had personal experience of those percussive sounds which vary in range from the tick of a watch to the blow of a sledgehammer. Further explanations, either then or later, included the theosophic doctrine, which admitted the facts but depreciated the spirits, describing them as astral shells with a sort of dreamy half-consciousness, or possibly an attenuated conscience which made them subhuman in their intelligence or morality. Certainly the quality of spirit communion does vary greatly, but the highest is so high that we can hardly imagine that we are in touch with only a fraction of the speaker. As it is asserted, however, that even in this world our subliminal self is far superior to our normal workaday individuality, it would seem only fair that the spirit world should confront us with something less than its full powers. Another theory postulates the anima mundi, a huge reservoir or central bank of intelligence, with a clearinghouse in which all inquiries are honored. The sharp detail which we receive from the other side is incompatible with any vague grandiose idea of the sort. Finally, there is the one really formidable alternative, that man has an etheric body with many unknown gifts, among which a power of external manifestation in curious forms may be included. It is to this theory of cryptesthesia that Trichet and others have clung, and up to a point there is an argument in its favor. The author has satisfied himself that there is a preliminary and elementary stage in all psychic work which depends upon the innate and possibly unconscious power of the medium. The reading of concealed script, the production of raps upon demand, the description of scenes at a distance, the remarkable effects of psychometry, the first vibrations of the direct voice ear, each and all of these on different occasions have seemed to emanate from the medium's own power. Then in most cases there would appear an outside intelligence which was able to appropriate that force and use it for its own ends. An illustration might be given in the experiments of Bisson and Schrenck-Notzing with Eva, where the ectoplasmic forms were at first undoubtedly reflections of newspaper illustrations, somewhat muddled by their passage through the medium's mind. Yet there came a later and deeper stage where an ectoplasmic form was evolved which was capable of movement and even of speech. Trichet's great brain and close power of observation have been largely centered upon the physical phenomena, and he does not seem to have been brought much in contact with those personal mental and spiritual experiences which would probably have modified his views. It is fair to add, however, that those views have continually moved in the direction of the spiritualistic explanation. There only remains the hypothesis of complex personality, which may well influence certain cases, though it seems to the author that such cases might be explained equally well by obsession. These instances, however, can only touch the fringe of the subject, and ignore the whole phenomenal aspect, so that the matter need not be taken very seriously. It cannot be too often repeated, however, that the inquirer should exhaust every possible normal explanation to his own complete satisfaction before he adopts the spiritualistic view. If he has done this, his platform is stable; if he has not done it, he can never be conscious of its solidity. The author can say truly, that year after year he clung on to every line of defense until he was finally compelled, if he were to preserve any claim to mental honesty, to abandon the materialistic position. 9. The career of D.D. Holm. Illustration of Daniel Douglas Holm. Daniel Douglas Holm was born in 1833 at Curry, a village near Edinburgh. There was a mystery about his parentage, and it has been both asserted and denied that he was related in some fashion to the family of the Earl of Holm. Certainly he was a man who inherited elegance of figure, delicacy of feature, sensitiveness of disposition and luxury in taste, from whatever source he sprang. But for his psychic powers, and for the earnestness which they introduced into his complex character, he might have been taken as the very type of the aristocratic younger son who inherits the tendencies, but not the wealth, of his forebears. Holm went from Scotland to New England, at the age of 9 years, with his aunt who had adopted him, a mystery still surrounding his existence. When he was 13 he began to show signs of the psychic faculties he had inherited, for his mother, who was descended from an old Highland family, had the characteristic second sight of her race. His mystical trend had shown itself in a conversation with his boyfriend, Edwin, about a short story where, as the result of a compact, a lover, after his death, manifested his presence to his lady love. The two boys pledged themselves that whoever died first would come and show himself to the other. home removed to another district some hundreds of miles distant, and about a month later, just after going to bed one night, he saw a vision of Edwin and announced to his aunt his death, news of which was received a day or two after. A second vision in 1850 concerned the death of his mother, who with her husband had gone to live in America. The boy was ill in bed at the time, and his mother away on a visit to friends at a distance. One evening he called loudly for help, and when his aunt came she found him in great distress. He said that his mother had died that day at 12 o'clock, that she had appeared to him and told him so. The vision proved to be only too true. Soon loud raps began to disturb the quiet household, and furniture to be moved by invisible agency. His aunt, a woman of a narrow religious type, declared the boy had brought the devil into her house, and turned him out of doors. He took refuge with friends, and in the next few years moved among them from town to town. His mediumship had become strongly developed, and at the houses where he stopped he gave frequent copyright answers, sometimes as many as 6 or 7 a day, for the limitations of power and the reactions between physical and psychic were little understood at that time. These proved a great drain on his strength, and he was frequently laid up with illness. People flocked from all directions to witness the marvels which occurred in Holmes' presence. Among those who investigated with him at this time was the American poet Bryant, who was accompanied by Professor Wells, of Harvard University. In New York he met many distinguished Americans, and three: Professor Hare, Professor Mapes, and Judge Edmonds, of the New York Supreme Court, had sittings with him. All three became, as already stated, convinced spiritualists. In these early years the charm of Holmes' personality, and the deep impression created by his powers, led to his receiving many offers. Professor George Bush invited him to stay with him and study for the Swedenborgian ministry, and Mr. and Mrs. Elmer, a rich and childless couple, who had grown to cherish a great affection for him, offered to adopt him and make him their heir on condition of his changing his name to Elmer. His remarkable healing powers had excited wonder and, yielding to the persuasion of friends, he began to study for the medical profession. But his general delicate health, coupled with actual lung trouble, forced him to abandon this project and, acting under medical advice, he left New York for England. He arrived in Liverpool on April 9, 1855, and has been described as a tall, slim youth with a marked elegance of bearing and a fastidious neatness of dress, but with a worn, hectic look upon his very expressive face which told of the ravages of disease. He was blue-eyed and auburn-haired, of a type which is peculiarly liable to the attack of tubercle, and the extreme emaciation of his frame showed how little power remained with him by which he might resist it. An acute physician watching him closely would probably have gauged his life by months rather than years in our humid climate, and of all the marvels which Holmes wrought, the prolongation of his own life was perhaps not the least. His character had already taken on those emotional and religious traits which distinguished it, and he has recorded how, before landing, he rushed down to his cabin and fell upon his knees in prayer. When one considers the astonishing career which lay before him, and the large part which he played in establishing those physical foundations which differentiate this religious development from many other, it may well be claimed that this visitor was among the most notable missionaries who has ever visited our shores. His position at that moment was a very singular one. He had hardly a relation in the world. His left lung was partly gone. His income was modest, though sufficient. He had no trade or profession, his education having been interrupted by his illness. In character he was shy, gentle, sentimental, artistic, affectionate, and deeply religious. He had a strong tendency both to art and the drama, so that his powers of sculpture were considerable, and as a recitator he proved in later life that he had few living equals. But on the top of all this, and of an unflinching honesty which was so uncompromising that he often offended his own allies, there was one gift so remarkable that it threw everything else into insignificance. This lay in those powers, quite independent of his own volition, coming and going with disconcerting suddenness, but proving to all who would examine the proof, that there was something in this man's atmosphere which enabled forces outside himself and outside our ordinary apprehension to manifest themselves upon this plane of matter. In other words, he was a medium of the greatest in a physical sense that the modern world has ever seen. A lesser man might have used his extraordinary powers to found some special sect of which he would have been the undisputed high priest, or to surround himself with a glamour of power and mystery. Certainly most people in his position would have been tempted to use it for the making of money. As to this latter point, let it be said at once that never in the course of the 30 years of his strange ministry did he touch 1 shilling as payment for his gifts. It is on sure record that as much as £2,000 was offered to him by the Union Club in Paris in the year 1857 for a single essay titled A Copyright Dance, and that he, a poor man and an invalid, utterly refused it. "I have been sent on a mission," he said. "That mission is to demonstrate immortality. I have never taken money for it and I never will." There were certain presents from royalty which cannot be refused without boorishness: rings, scarf pins, and the like ear tokens of friendship rather than recompense, for before his premature death there were few monarchs in Europe with whom this shy youth from the Liverpool landing stage was not upon terms of affectionate intimacy. Napoleon III provided for his only sister. The Emperor of Russia sponsored his marriage. What novelist would dare to invent such a career? But there are more subtle temptations than those of wealth. Holmes' uncompromising honesty was the best safeguard against those. Never for a moment did he lose his humility and his sense of proportion. "I have these powers," he would say, "I shall be happy, up to the limit of my strength, to demonstrate them to you, if you approach me as one gentleman should approach another. I shall be glad if you can throw any further light upon them. I will lend myself to any reasonable experiment. I have no control over them. They use me, but I do not use them. They desert me for months and then come back in redoubled force. I am a passive instrument and no more." Such was his unvarying attitude. He was always the easy, amiable man of the world, with nothing either of the mantle of the prophet or of the skullcap of the magician. Like most truly great men, there was no touch of pose in his nature. An index of his fine feeling is that when confirmation was needed for his results he would never quote any names unless he was perfectly certain that the owners would not suffer in any way through being associated with an unpopular cult. Sometimes even after they had freely given leave he still withheld the names, lest he should unwittingly injure a friend. When he published his first series of Incidents in My Life, the Saturday Review waxed very sarcastic over the anonymous evidence of Countess O, Count Bar, Count de K, Princess de Bar and Mrs. Sar, who were quoted as having witnessed manifestations. In his second volume, Home, having assured himself of the concurrence of his friends, filled the blanks with the names of the Countess Orsini, Count de Beaumont, Count de Comma, Princess de Beauve, and the well-known American hostess, Mrs. Henry Sr. His royal friends he never quoted at all, and yet it is notorious that the Emperor Napoleon, the Empress Eugenie, the Tsar Alexander, the Emperor William I of Germany, and the kings of Bavaria and Württemberg were all equally convinced by his extraordinary powers. Never once was Home convicted of any deception, either in word or in deed. On first landing in England he took up his quarters at Cox's Hotel in Jermyn Street, and it is probable that he chose that hostelry because he had learned that through Mrs. Hayden's ministry the proprietor was already sympathetic to the cause. However that may be, Mr. Cox quickly discovered that his young guest was a most remarkable medium, and at his invitation some of the leading minds of the day were asked to consider those phenomena which Home could lay before them. Among others, Lord Brougham came to essay tilde copyright dance and brought with him his scientific friend, Sir David Brewster. In full daylight they investigated the phenomena, and in his amazement at what happened Brewster is reported to have said, "This upsets the philosophy of 50 years. If he had said 1500 he would have been within the mark." He described what took place in a letter written to his sister at the time, but published long after. Those present were Lord Brougham, Sir David Brewster, Mr. Cox and the medium. We four, said Brewster, sat down at a moderately sized table, the structure of which we were invited to examine. In a short time the table struggled, and a tremulous motion ran up all our arms. At our bidding these motions ceased and returned. The most unaccountable rappings were produced in various parts of the table, and the table actually rose from the ground when no hand was upon it. A larger table was produced, and exhibited similar movements.